I'm Meera, an associated member of ML4Q, and you are listening to ML4Q&A, a show where members from the Matter and Light for Quantum Computing cluster talk about their careers, their research, and the future of quantum. In today's episode, we are excited to have Christine Silberhorn on the podcast. She is currently a professor at the University of Paderborn. She has been awarded numerous awards for her research and is also a member of the Academy of Science and Arts of Nordrhein-Westfalia since 2020. She was also appointed to the Science Council of Germany in 2023. We will hear, among other things, about her views and education in this episode. Christine has been working actively in developing integrated quantum optical systems and is a prominent figure in experimental quantum optics. What makes photonic quantum computing particularly important is the integration of flying qubits for the purpose of quantum communication. If you are keen to know how photonic quantum computing works and how it can be integrated on a chip, look no further. Hello, Christine. It's good to have you here today with us. You've been a professor at the Paderborn University since 2010, and your research mainly involves experimental quantum optics.
Yes, it is. So my main field is quantum optics, and to be more specific, it's photonics. So I'm one of the persons who really have a close look at what is a photon and what can we do with photons.
How would you describe quantum optics? Do you think it's almost a subdiscipline?
A subdiscipline? So what I'm doing are quantum optics in general. So I think quantum optics is a very broad field, right? It involves atoms, photons, and all kinds of different fields. And something like a discipline which is a sub-discipline and maybe also have some of these is photonics. And my field of research is really photonics, where we concentrate a lot more on photons than on atoms.
Okay. But then there are certain kind of interdisciplinary part between these two fields. So I think we would just probably try to understand this photonics and photonic quantum computing from both sides. So one of the things that quantum optics made headlines for was in 2015 when the first direct gravitational wave detection was made at LIGO. And this was possible because of interferometry, which is also a big part of photonics. So could you explain a little what this was?
Yes, I'm very happy to do so, because indeed, when I was studying quantum optics, photonics in this field, it really came from fundamental science. And there already, as early in the early 2000s, people said the first application will be quantum interferometry, quantum interferometers, quantum metrology, and these things. So it's interesting, this is the traditional way of photonics. And you said then in 2015, there was a breakthrough from the technological side. On the fundamental side, we knew that really for quite some time. There was, of course, Carlton Caves, who really said, how can we deal with that? And this is an old paper. And they were, of course, the pioneers. If you want to understand what is really quantum about photons, there's Roy Glauber's stuff with the correlation functions. And quantum optics, in that sense, has really originated, I think, from the ideas, how can we describe light as photons? And I think during the time when I was doing my PhD in the early 2000s, we saw a revolution because quantum information came there, quantum information processing. I was actually part of the first quantum information processing Schwerpunktsprogramm in Germany, where people for the first time really said, okay, what can we do with it? And you're absolutely correct. There were a lot of other pioneers, amongst them, Gerard Milburn, Anton Zeilinger, of course, everybody knows him now. But it was an exciting time, and I'm still fascinated by that. Bridging fundamental science, where photons always had one key role. Quantum optics is so nice, this photonic quantum optics, because it can test all kinds of principle, and bringing them over to a technology where the technology is actually quite broad. It's quantum communication, it's quantum metrology, and it's quantum computation. And photons has a big advantage that you can play with all of these different fields when you do research in that area.
We mentioned a few names, big names like Carlton Caves, Glauber, Zeilinger. Do you think their work in particular contributed in transitioning quantum optics as a fundamental field from, or like an academic field to technology?
Well, for sure. I mentioned them already because all of them. So I think Carlton Caves, there you said the gravitational waves. This is where he came up with this idea. How can you play with the light pressure and how can you use quantum systems of that? Roy Glauber is a person who, in my opinion, put the foundations there. A very basic, it goes dates back to the 60s. Also, he got his Nobel Prize much later. But understanding what correlations is, understanding what laser light is in a quantum description was fundamental. So he is one of the earliest ones. And Gerald Milburn, well, you know the KLM scheme, so he's the one who kind of pushed the quantum computing side there. And Anton Zeilinger, well, his work is related with all of the basic concepts, but really I think going from fundamental science and what does it mean in the language of quantum information, this is where he had the contribution. And at that time, of course, many more should be mentioned. Alain Spee, there's a lot of people who have contributed to that because it was really at the early 2000s, it was a fascinating area. Charles Bennett. So the quantum communication, you can name a whole list of different people who really pushed the field. And brought it from a quantum optics side, which is fascinating for itself, from a fundamental side, to ideas which were truly interdisciplinary. I think this is what happened. And via the interdisciplinarity, then it came to technology. But for me, there's different things. It's first physics fundamental, then interdisciplinary fundamental in like quantum information science. And then there's technology. And at the moment, we try to bring in the engineers. And this is really something which is still at the transition phase. And it's all not easy. To going all these steps is always tricky.
Yes. When were you first introduced to quantum optics or photonics? And did these big players have some sort of an influence on you?
Well, I really started entering the field completely from scratch when I was doing my PhD, because before my PhD, I was not even doing physics. So I did study physics in maths and physics grammar school teachers, but I was not at all in a physics research environment. So I didn't do a master's, a diploma, anything in physics. So I really started right away, 1999, 2000, where basically it was the first Schwerpunkt program of the DFG. So this was basically, I was one of the first generation of quantum information processing. And this was Gerd Leuchs together with Werner and Bethe at that time, who created for Germany this new research area. And it was pretty new. And actually, I was only accepted as a PhD student at my position was because this program started.
So that's very interesting. Did you, at when you were doing your PhD, did you already think that time that you would want to get into academia?
Not really. I wanted to do something new. And at the beginning, well, it was a complicated situation to some extent because I was studying teacher's diploma and one couldn't imagine that. It was really very difficult to get positions at that time to become a teacher. And I wanted to do something else in between. That was the idea why I started my PhD. Having said that, once entering the research group of Gerd Leuchs, I was getting extremely quickly, extremely fascinated. And it took only half a year or less than a year that I was completely into it. And I knew that I really want to do work along that line.
So after your PhD at Nuremberg, you did a postdoc and you were a junior research fellow at Oxford. Then you moved back to Germany at the Max Planck Institute. Why do you think the Max Plancks are so popular?
Okay, let me first say something because I think it was a very important step for me to go to Oxford for 2 years. And that was again So I was already integrated in the community, and it was another lucky coincidence that Ian Walmsley asked me or accepted me as a PhD student. This was the other next step. It broadened my understanding what research is a lot. I had already in Erlangen back there in the group a lot of international contacts, which was great. And I learned what it means to do international research. And Oxford, of course, broadened it a lot. And I was extremely lucky with my supervisors who really also fostered my career. Now, why Max Planck? I think, so for me, Max Planck is, of course, one of the way where you can do research in a very concentrated way. Max Planck kind of is targeted towards a thing doing excellent research. And if you like international, high quality, excellent research, of course, Max Planck is always a location where you can get good resources and a good environment. They select excellent people. People are very engaged to work there and like to be hardworking. And I think that's one of the things. If you enjoy this and you really want to go forward, Max Planck is definitely one option where you can really do excellent things. You see, I said it's one option because in my case, I also went back to Erlangen, as you see from my career. And I also was very much involved in the university life. And I think I really enjoyed that I was not only Max Planck at that time, but because I had extremely close contacts to university too. And I think for a young person starting out a career, it's good to have a university affiliation. It's good to teach. And I have both worlds.
How was your experience in all of these places? They are sort of hubs for quantum optics.
And to be honest, if you know the German systems, I wouldn't fully agree. Because in Germany, we have a lot of extremely good research groups. And yes, you're right, they are hubs. But at the time when I was going there, I was going to Max Planck, but it was a Max Planck research group where I was working in Erlangen, which was only in the process of becoming Max Planck. Okay. The starting point is always excellent researchers. And I think that's the point, excellent research groups, where one researcher really wants to push his subject. And Germany is strong, not because of having extremely strong hubs, but of having extremely good individual researchers. And they can be everywhere. And I think I enjoyed Oxford a lot. I enjoyed Max Planck a lot. But you see, I'm now in Paderborn, and this is not when I came here. There was an excellent researcher, for sure, who really pushed the thing, but it was not a hub. So I think we should really think about these hubs are fascinating and maybe we need them now for developing technology. Don't want to defend them, but I want to make a little bit of advertisement that there are also excellent researchers with very strong groups all across Germany. And this is one of the big benefits we have in the German environment.
Yes. This is also in a way, what ML4Q does, they try to connect all these researchers and places to work together. So on that, what made you decide to join the next round of ML4Q?
It is the experience of working together with people having different experience. It is the experience of working together with people from different universities and creating an environment in North Rhine-Westphalia at that time, which really allows us to do excellent research across all kinds of different institutions. We have in North Rhine-Westphalia different structures like Ein Quantum NRW and these things, and I think we should work together. And this is not only for me, it was not only me personally joining, but ML4Q for me was important. For me as a person who is a spokesperson of the FOX, it's not only me individually, but it is really we as the FOX, the Institute for Photonic Quantum System in Paderborn, would like to establish bridges and would like to contribute with our expertise and would like to learn from you. And I think this is the big chance we have, create something beyond what's existing. And I saw that was a big opportunity for myself, yes, of course, but of which is more important for the different places where we are. And we should really connect, be a strong team altogether.
And how did you view ML4Q before you became a part of it as like an external person?
That's a good question. I think ML4Q definitely is strong. And it is strong because you already have established a great network. You have your expertise in quantum computation, for sure. You have expertise in quantum communication already. But of course, I saw it very complementary what we do, because we have very much our expertise in photonics. That's a much more specialized way of looking into that, where we are strong in that. So, of course, ML4Q is strong. How could it not be? It's an excellent center. I had visited all your meetings. I think you have a great place there. On the other hand, as I said, for photonics, I think it's good that there's some other people where you can probably also see that. And this is how I saw ML4Q. And it's one of the big centers. It is a hub to some extent, but I'm very happy that's an open hub.
Yeah, I mean, you are also one of the first people on the ML4 Q&A podcast who's going to talk to us about photonic quantum computing. So, indeed. Before we go now to talk about your research or to learn more about photonic quantum computing, I wanted to touch on another subject which you have stood up for, that is women in physics. You have advocated for that and have co-written the Women for Quantum Manifesto of Values. How did this come together?
Yeah, I'm very happy and to some extent privileged that I'm part of this group. I should say that I'm really happy to participate in these things. I'm not one of the driving force at the moment because of time constraints. The Women for Quantum really started as an informal meeting. People, females who met each other in a conference place at one of the locations of one of the Women for Quantum people, and just were talking about things. And I think that was the nice thing. It was a sharing of experiences. And when you share experiences, you realize that you are in a special role if you want it or if you don't want it. And you also realize that there are some problems you have. And from that, all that originated. But it was not like a movement, we want to do something, but it was more like on a personal level. And it still is like that. We are very careful that we help each other, that we talk to each other, and that we kind of share experiences. And this is really something important. And we are very careful that the things, the statements we make to the outside world can be an opinion expressed by everybody, and to create also a group where you can have trust, because that's very important, because it's a rather delicate question and we are very much aware of that. It's not something against anyone or something, but it's really something, well, we see that we need some ways of sharing experiences. And then from this shared experience, we want to say, what do we think should change or needs to change that we really can have not only equal rights, I think we have equal rights, but we feel equally integrated in the science community.
How do you think we can go from values to concrete actions to create a better situation for women and men in quantum computing?
This is one of the questions we're discussing a lot, and I think you're sorry by my answer. This is not a trivial one. And how can we create from values to actions? The point is, the first thing is you have to talk to people, and you should make clear that it's what I said already. There is no easy path. And if you ask 10 females, you will get 10 different answers. You saw the manifesto. It was really a process. And you should express things first. And before you can come up with good actions, you have to diagnose very well what is really common to everybody. Because there's a personal experience and there's the common thing. One thing which is clear, that it's not a personal problem of the people. That's something I can say, that quite frequently females feel isolated. They say, oh, and you hear that a lot. Oh, that's your problem because it's you. And realizing that it's not you, but it's a structural problem of just how the society thinks. And I think it's a bias, which is well beyond just recognized. It's the first step one. And then one thing which is also clear, we don't want to kind of substitute. Now we have males, we put females and everything is fine. This won't work. It has to be a cultural change. And this is what we are advertising at the moment. So I guess this answer is a little bit disappointing. But it's an honest one.
No, I think it's truly that we should first be aware of what the problems are. And then we can work towards taking action on them.
And raise awareness also towards the men. I think we have to explain very concretely. Maybe I can give you an example, because I really, this topic is very important. So you know that in the Fox, I also try to create an environment which kind of lives these values. And we created one workshop, which is particular for females, or for kind of getting them into the group. And this is a conference where we just ask more experienced females to present their results and themselves. And we invite males equally to females, but we kind of just say the constraint, there should never be more males than females. Okay. Such that once you have the experience that you have more females. And interestingly, I got the response from the males that it's a really weird situation if you are outnumbered by females. And these are these experiences we kind of have to create. There can be different ways to do that, but it's not about talking, it's about experiencing.
Yes, that's true. I mean, it's something that perhaps has not been normal for them until now, but then the more you do it, the more it would become normal. So do you think that there's a difference between quantum physics and the rest of physics or STEM in general when it comes to gender issues?
That's hard to say. I personally always experienced the quantum optics community as a very friendly environment in general. So, but now I say I experience, because this probably is a personal way. And having said that, nevertheless, if you see who are the big names, don't get me wrong, are the names which are known. And in particular, if you go to experimental physics, you will soon find that there are not too many females. So my statement should be taken maybe with a little bit of care. I probably was lucky in some sense anyhow that I found things. As I said, I'm not so sure if it's really different. What I can tell you that there is still a problem, and it's very obvious. If you look at the numbers, they're just not high. And if you look at the numbers, how many females study physics and STEM, and you see how many professors, and then you see how many really leaders are there, there is definitely an issue, because the numbers go down and down and down.
Yeah. That's true. Why do you think it is hard for women to be at high positions? Was it so also during your time, or and is it still so, or is it getting better?
Unfortunately, I'm very pessimistic these days in that sense. Why is it hard? Because our society is not used to it. And it's not probably not only not used to it, it's really not up to it. If you ask me, is it getting better? Ooh, I think it is in the long term, but it's getting very slowly better. And I had the feeling that after Corona, it was actually going worse. And
Okay.
one thing, my personal belief, always if money and power is getting involved, females drop out. Or not, they don't drop out, they kind of are lost in the system. And if you now ask me about quantum technology, I have a little bit the feeling that going from fundamental science to a technology, that this creates a situation where it's actually getting harder for females than easier. But this
Okay.
is again, it's a very general statement and one would have to do research in that. But for sure, it's not something which just works. And it's hard, not because of things which you can directly measure. It's hard because sometimes you feel you're not heard in the same way. If you represent things, people just see it differently. It's hard, as I said, because society is really not used to accept females in the same way than males. And to some extent, that's also normal because there is a difference. But we have to find ways how we deal with our way on doing science that females feel the same way welcomed. And I can tell you that's not the case at the moment. From sharing these experiences, it simply is not.
Yes, I mean it's also very difficult to talk about this topic in the open, and many people are, so to say, afraid also in some sense to discuss this. But then, yeah, how do you think we can approach this topic, even just to discuss it openly?
It is very difficult, to be honest. And I say the younger I was, the less I wanted to talk about that. Because it's a very natural thing. You want to be equal. And I think that's fair. And you don't want to be singled out, neither in the positive or the negative way. And of course, you don't want to talk why you are special and why you need special help. And I phrase it deliberately in a very nasty way, but at the end, this is what it is. This is also why for Women for Quantum, there were a lot of more senior persons involved because the more senior you are, I can talk more easily about that because I don't have to be afraid that it will have two negative effects on the career. That's the first thing I think, which is important. Although also that I should say is not easily granted. There's always the thing. How to talk about that? I think one thing you saw what we did with the manifesto. Don't speak for your own only, but make sure that a larger group stands for it. Because then the singling out, it's you, it's your personal thing, can be avoided by that. Also, think that you don't want to gain power for you personally, but you say that there's a problem. And this is, I think,
Yes.
the ways we should approach it. And on the individual level, I think we have to start to do the same things. If positions are advertised, I think it's not so good if there's a female-only position, but if there are several positions, like 10 positions advertised, say a certain percentage of that should be females. This gives you a little bit of protection. Everything which is very individual is always very difficult. Everything which is kind of more broad that you can't point to an individual makes it easier. And then, of course, the other thing is we need individual support. So I try to do that, not in public, but really private discussions, mentoring, and these things. I experienced that in my career. I think that's most helpful because everybody struggles. Doing a scientific career, and you will experience, is not easy. And then to get personal advice is extremely helpful.
Yeah, for sure. But apart from just in academia, do you think that the quantum industry is a chance to advance women's participation in physics?
I'm very skeptical about that, to be honest, unfortunately.
Okay.
Well, industry is not particularly good, I think. If you go for the STEM industry in Germany, it's not that there's everything much better than academia. Sorry for saying that, but in principle, you have the opposite problem there, that's even getting worse. Now, I wouldn't say that necessarily the quantum industry is particularly bad. Maybe it's good because it is a startup culture and there's a different culture. And I would wish that this culture kind of also has a different culture, different values where females feel more welcomed. But I can tell you it will definitely not happen just because it happens like that. There would have to be special efforts to put into that.
Yes.
And we can help with academia that we can create that. But I would be skeptical that industry helps us to have more females in, unless, and this is one thing, industry really needs extremely high qualified scientists. And of course, the positive scenario would be that they realize if we really want to have extremely good people, we also need the resource of female people. Maybe I would be happy to see that. But as I said, it will not be the easy way or something which just will happen.
Yeah, of course. So we can now come back to your research or are working on integrating photonics on chips. We know that it is important for a quantum computer to have a means of state preparation to demonstrate a universal set of quantum gates and a reliable measurement strategy. So how does this work for photons?
Yeah, this is very interesting. Maybe from a global perspective, what is the difference between photons and actually all other implementations of quantum computers? And there's a big difference because in all other platforms, I think, or mostly, what you have, your information storage and your information carry, the qubit encoding is done on the matter qubits, atoms or whatever it is. And then the processing do via light. So you shine light beam or by electromagnetic waves, if you want. Yeah. So this is a standard way. Now, if you talk about photonic quantum computing, the reverse is true. So we kind of encode our information on light, and then we do the processing by matter. What I mean by that, the information carrier itself are the photons, where we encode in different ways, in different strategies, our information. And then the processing means you're going through a circuitry, which basically is beam split operations, but it's the matter which kind of brings these interferences together. And then we do a measurement. Now, okay, you can say, so what? Well, so what means that a lot of the strategies and a lot of the algorithms which are developed for most other quantum computing platforms don't work so nicely for photons. You can translate them, but we have very different problems. What I mean by that, if you hold your information on any matter qubit, then the biggest problem is decoherence. You can't hold it for long because you start defacing and things, and then it's not getting reliable and it's completely defaced, then you have a classical thing. This is not really true in photons. If you have a photon, if you propagate it, the defacing is not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is that you just lose it. And this, you see, Ari, this is a big difference because it's then just gone. And this is why the algorithms and that is very different. And the second problem is that nonlinear interactions is one of the big problems. And if you phrase that typically a quantum computer, you always have a nonlinear interaction and you're not transforming systems only in superpositions. And the interaction between two photons is extremely weak. We would love to have a situation that we have two photons on something happening and we have a strong nonlinear action and then we can do phase changes. This doesn't work. The big thing was that we can see they can replace these things by measurements. This is where measurement-induced systems come in. And the big player there is the so-called Hongo-Mandel interference. It's very interesting if you have two photons which imping on a single on a 50-50 beam splitter, that the photons where they leave, the output statistics are different when you have photons than classical light. This is a very fundamental property, but this is the main property where all of the magic of photonic quantum computation comes in. And it's not only that they go out in different parts, but going out in these different statistics are seen when you measure it. And now you understand why these measurements are so important. And this is to be explored. There's different algorithms which have been explored. The first Nibbler from Melbourne things where people really thought, okay, yes, we can use that. We can do consistent statistics and we can implement gates in that way. And then other schemes came up with that. So you build larger systems, entanglement and feed forward and what have you. Then you can map a gate-based system. That's the one approach of photonics. Or you can ask from a fundamental point of view, what if you put a lot of photons onto a large system, on the circuitry, what statistics do you get? And then you enter to the field of Gaussian boson sampling or boson sampling per se, which is something I would say is not like a gate-based algorithm, but it you can encode problems which classical computer can't compute. And this is the reason why this photonic quantum advantage that if you have has been done with different states. But this is why it's very different to talk about photonic quantum information processing, if you call it computers or simulations, is quite different and often also quite difficult to understand for the other platforms than all other platforms.
So you did mention boson sampling, and that has also been in the news for a while now. So is it a benchmark to show more complex quantum optical experiments? How do you compare this with gate-based quantum supremacy experiments?
Well, I have been working on boson sampling quite some time. And I think it's for sure a benchmark, and this is why I explained to you the Hongemandel interference effect, because that's at the heart of a measurement-based, gate-based photonic quantum computing, as well as boson sampling experiments. And maybe it's useful to have a look back in 2018-19. People said photons will never make a big storyline, because the biggest problem we have in photonic is the preparation of the input states, so the first initial state preparation, and still is one of the big issues. And people didn't start believing that you can scale at all, because this is really one of the big challenges. It's a challenge which people have put a lot of work in, and we also see progress. But if you really want to do a gate-based, full-fledged quantum computer, what you need for that is an extremely good single photon source or entangled sources, what we call in a discrete variable system. Now, nevertheless, you can prepare other non-classical states, so-called squeeze states or Gaussian states. And this is where boson sampling was transformed to Gaussian boson sampling. Actually, this was quite funny because we proposed it together with colleagues Igor Jeks in Prague and Craig Hamilton, where we discussed how can we at least show that there is a possibility of scaling things using the same hardware, using the same Hongemandel interference effects, using a very similar approach from an experimental point of view. And then you come to the field of continuous variable systems, where I actually did my PhD. And then you see, okay, there are these non-classical states, squeezed light, which we're going back to the gravitational wave things. And if you use those and send them through the same circuitry, so to speak, from the same processing things, and you ask what the outcome, the surprising answer is, and this is what boson sampling is, or Gaussian boson sampling is, that a classical computer can't calculate the output statistics without errors. So what does that mean? It kind of brought, and then in Chan-Pei Pan's on Choyang Lu's group, people demonstrated that and people were completely fascinated. For me, that was funny, because when I was telling people about Gaussian boson sampling in Europe, they said that's boring. When it was then done, people thought it's fantastic. So you see how things also change.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, from a scientific view, it shows you that you can do with photonics interesting things and probably can also become technologically relevant. And you shouldn't get frustrated if people tell you that's not what we want to hear with the same hardware. And I think that's very important, because in photonics, we need good tests of hardware. And there are these experiments to show how can we scale system? What does that mean? And to stimulate the development of new algorithms, because in my opinion, that's the biggest problem we have in photonics. We need algorithms which are tailored to the things we can do. We need these other experiments. It's an intermediate step, for sure. But to be fair, also in other platforms, it's not the full-fledged error-corrected quantum computer yet. We go a different pathway, if you want to say. And if you want to understand, can we scale system? Can we build up complex systems? Is there a chance that we can build photonic quantum computers? These are the steps which we need to do because it tests our hardware and it stimulates new algorithm development.
As compared to other platforms, does photonic quantum computing have certain advantages? So what I can think of is when you're working with squeezed light, it might be particularly better for quantum error correction, so to say. One of the things that I can think of is this. For photonics, I think it might just be easier to also integrate quantum communication, say quantum networks and things like that. So what do you say? How does photonic quantum computing compare with other platforms?
Thanks a lot. You already gave some hints where to look at. I think photonics, definitely in terms of how difficult it is, photonics has the potential of being much easier. Maybe not for having fully error-corrected things. I'm not sure if error correction is easier. I would be rather skeptical about that, but no matter. But if you think about the hardware itself, photonics has been since a long time pioneering new concepts. And if you then ask about boson sampling or sampling algorithm at all, I think it's fair to say that the sampling ideas came from photonics too. Which is also a big storyline now for other platforms. So photonics has, it's not easy, don't get me wrong, but in comparison to other systems, they can be easier. There's a good potential that you can operate them at much higher temperatures. At the moment, detectors are the problem. You can integrate them, and this is also a big advantage. And the last thing you mentioned is extremely important. If you think that you want to use any information processing, let's call it like that, together with communication lines, together with metrology lines, with all other things, of course, photonics has a big advantage because the information is already encoded into flying qubits. So you have already this, I started with that. It's the starting point is a flying qubit. So you kind of, if you think about the quantum internet, if you make the vision big, I can't see a way that you connect things on a larger scale without photonics. So yes. I think the role of photonics there is very special. We can, on the one hand, have conceptual ideas and test it, and there probably we have harder ways of developing good concepts. I should be fair on that. But from the hardware side and from the integration, it's easy, relatively easy. And from the way of applications in other fields, in neighboring fields, quantum communication, quantum networking, and quantum metrology, I think it's fair to say that there will no be way out of it. If you think about distributed quantum computing over hundreds of kilometers, I don't know how you do it if you don't use photons.
Yeah. How important are quantum repeaters? We can maybe also here talk about the synergies between quantum processors and the requirement for quantum repeaters and quantum network.
Well, in photonics, it's an obvious thing, right? So if you're talking about quantum communication, quantum repeaters at one, the system. Quantum repeaters are developed right now, and I think it's an exciting topic. A lot of components which you need to implement quantum repeaters are the same which you will use at the end for quantum computers. All the integrated circuitries are very similar. So this is something where the synergy is very obvious. One bottleneck for both for computation as well, I think for the repeaters in the long term, is that we need fast modulators without losses. So fast feed-forward operations. It's one of the things which are right now. People try to develop that. One of the things which kind of is missing for quantum repeaters is, oh, it's not missing, it's a research field which is important, is quantum memories. And what that means is exactly how do we link flying qubits to stationary qubits. I think one could express that how to connect different platforms in computation. Yeah. It's the same thing. So I think from a photonics perspective, the research you have to do or the challenges you have to overcome are extremely similar.
At some point, you also did mention that the predominant error sort of in photonics quantum computing is the loss of a photon. So one can choose codes that are particularly good at fixing this sort of error. So for example, the dual rail qubit. Do you think then that the problem is not that difficult?
I'm not 100% sure if I understand what you mean, that the dual rail qubit is the one which is particularly loss resilient. I think what maybe I see it a little bit from a different perspective. You can map errors which are decoherence errors into errors which are loss errors, and the dual rail encoding was used for that, to be a little bit more precise on that. And yes, as far as I know from literature, the results, they are impressive from the circuitry, how we can counteract losses. And I think that's one way to go. I think there you see that people have really developed good algorithms. That's my opinion on that. It has a large overhead in terms of resources, and it requires feed-forward operation. So one should be honest on that. For long-term goal, I think, yes, if we can handle that, then one of the main obstacles are overcome. There's other ways which we can work with that, and there you can look at squeezed light. Honestly, there you're starting off with more photons and you can lose more. Now, what I want to say there is finding good ways of battling losses is the main challenge for photonic. If we master that, and it doesn't depend either we come up with algorithms who are not sensible to that, and from a state preparation up to the detection, then the problems of photonics are solved. And there you see again the connection to communication. There also losses is the topic. So yes. If you ask what is the biggest challenge or one of the biggest challenges in photonics, it is overcoming losses for sure.
We can also discuss a little on the different components of photonic quantum computing. We also in passing mentioned single photon and entangled photon sources. Is there one which stands better than the rest that you think are now preferable for photonics quantum computing?
I already discussed with you the difference between boson sampling, Gaussian boson sampling, and measurement-based systems. And there, the other big thing is which sources should you use? And the progress has been impressive from different sources. I think if you talk specifically about photonics, there are semiconductor sources and there's parametric down conversion sources.
Yes.
And in the long run, of course, the so-called deterministic sources with quantum dots have a very good perspective because they are capable of preparing single photons, at least technologically, and also have in the preparation or entangled states involved. And if we really talk about schemes which encode into single photon states, this is a very promising approach. One should say that. Now, if you go a little bit more near term or go to other encoding schemes like Gaussian boson sampling, there's also continuous variable schemes. Parametric down conversions are much more mature. So if you ask the big experiments which have been done in photonics, including work of Zeilinger, a lot of things, they all have been done with parametric down conversion sources, and they are much easier. We ask already how easy it is. A parametric down conversion source operates at room temperature and can be rather easily fully integrated in a circuit. So I think this is a question of what do you want to do? So for communication purposes, I could think if you come up with good algorithms, the parametric down conversion can really be, well, it's still the workhorse of a lot of photonic quantum computation. If you really want to implement a large quantum computer, a lot of people believe that quantum dots will be the future. And I wouldn't strictly oppose to it. But for me, both things are research lines, to be honest. And I don't think that it will be the one or the other, like we discuss a lot of things. It will be, what do you want to achieve? Which processing do you aim for?
Do you say it's the same with detectors? So we have on the one side these avalanche detectors, which are semiconductors based, and then we have also the superconducting ones. What are the advantages of one versus the other?
To some extent, yes. To some extent, no. So if you think about communication applications and metrology where efficiency or losses don't play that crucial role, and these applications exist, of course, then avalanche photodiodes are great because they basically can be operated room temperature. And of course, it's a big advantage. However, if we really think about quantum computation, I think almost nobody uses any more avalanche photodiodes because superconducting detectors are simply have much higher efficiency, and the efficiency is so important that there are superconducting nanowire detectors in one or the other form kind of took over. You see that in the labs. If you go to quantum optics labs, I think there exist almost no quantum optics labs anymore where no superconducting detectors are used. And they also become much more easy to be handled because they become much more also put into racks and things. So there, on the detector side, it's definitely, I think, for quantum applications, superconducting detectors are the choice to go. If you go very applied for industry applications, as I said, there it might be a slightly different.
Okay. And how are these two components the most easily integrated into a quantum chip?
For superconducting detectors, it's not a problem, so to speak. If you can have integrated chips, and on the integrated chips there, we have really one area where we can put superconducting material and then it can be fully integrated. And we do that also in Paderborn here. The only disadvantage you have is you have to put them the whole chip and everything again to cryogenic temperatures. But that's the way and the strategy people think, that you just integrate the superconducting detectors onto the chip, and this works. The progress there is quite impressive. So this does work, but it relates to something I also have mentioned already, is to feed forward operations, some measurements. And there, this is still a challenge because you have to have things where you have extremely low latency times and where you have to have a detection event, and putting on the detection, you have to do something on the circuitry. Now, since photons are flying, you have to be extremely quick, or you have to have some memories. And now you get see how things come together. And this is where we stand on the technological side at the moment.
And what about the single photon sources? How can those be integrated on chips?
Again, there is a lot of work integration where you put onto the chips different materials, typically quantum dots with cavities and everything. So this is completely feasible. Again, you have to put them into cavities. So this works. So photonics can integrate everything. I think this is why it's fascinating. I should say in Paderborn, we're doing a lot of things on lithium niobate, which is a Ki2 material. And this is one key element for modulation. If you want to have low loss modulation, you must have appropriate materials, and Ki2 is one material choice. And as I said, this is one of the challenges we face. And Ki2 materials have a lot of advantages for parametric down conversion because you have a cleaner systems, but also for modulations. This is why we target Ki2 materials, in particular lithium niobate in Paderborn. And this is the strength of this place here. And there has been fascinating work with thin film lithium niobates of the last 10 years, where we think that we can really also push the frontiers of quantum information processing quite significantly.
So you're also experimenting with different materials?
We mostly focus on non-linear materials and there on lithium niobate. There other materials could be interesting. So we have looked at other Ki2 materials. We haven't been focusing so much on Ki3 materials and other materials there because they are commercially available. And to be honest, everything which you can buy from fabs, as an academic institution, you rather stay away from that because it's not a question of research there, but of money. It just costs a lot of money. And having fabs for circuitries is a billion market, where for an academic institution, that's probably not the right way to go.
What do you think is the role of fast electronics in optical quantum computing?
It's extremely important, as I told you. One of the elements we need is feed forward. And feed forward relies on the fact that you have extremely fast electronics and that you can do co-designs at the end. This is how one can envision it, of fast electronics, ideally superconducting fast electronics, and suitable circuits, which ideally would be Ki2 circuits. And we are not there yet. But this integration of fast electronics and optical circuitries is actually another topic where we also are strong in FOX, where we put these things together. And there you already realize that there's a lot of standard know-how to bring things together. If we talk about photonics, the big advantage is that there exists a lot of know-how you can build upon. The issue is you need all this know-how to build all of them on top of each other, and you have to have them at a place. And it's not cheap at the end of the day. So this is one of the things why FOX is created like it is. It's physicists, experimental physics, from integrated quantum optics, from semiconductor physics, together with engineers of system designs, with fast electronics. We also need mathematicians and computer scientists who develop new algorithms. Having all that together is not an easy way. I think it never is, but in photonics, I think, well, it's at least the equally hard challenge if you want to really have a fully integrated circuitry. You can do a lot of experiments, but having everything integrated is still some way to go.
You are also involved in a big project, the FoQuant project, which focuses on realizing industry-relevant applications. Could you give us some example of these applications?
I'm not sure if I agree that it should bring academic world to industry. This is how I would phrase it. So it's about building demonstrators and photonic quantum demonstrators and make them more readily available for applications. I'm not sure how other people would answer that, but in a serious way that industry really sells them is not the case. It's not the case for photonics, but I think it's also not really true for many applications on that. So what we focus and focus on that is two things. First of all, to really try to get systems which can build rather large, well, like worldwide, rather complex systems and test applications. There are examples of Gaussian boson samplings where people test things, which is something like vibrational levels of spectroscopy. These kind of things can be tested. There's graph theoretical questions where we can implement these things, and we do that. We see how well these applications work. And this is, I think, an important starting point to connect to industry. And then the second question is always, is there a quantum advantage? And this is a second line where there has been photonic systems, information processing system, where advantage was shown, and this is a question of scaling. And both these goals are kind of approached in FoQuant, although the scaling is not directly at the focus. The focus there is really integration, which is an important topic as we discussed. And the second focus is build up complex systems and show some applications where industry can connect to.
You also have quite a large focus group. Do you find that management takes up most of your time, or are you also able to participate actively and devote a lot of time to research itself?
Unfortunately, management takes much more time than I would like to. But I believe I still actively participate in my own research. It's always too little time, I should say. This is, and I should be honest, creating an institute, creating a large, running a large research group, and bringing all these expertises together on different levels causes a lot of management overhead. And I have a lot of people help me a lot, I should say. It's not only me, it's a strong team behind me. Nevertheless, also for me personally, a lot of my time I spend on management and also service to the community, the science community, the research community in Germany. And I think people who have the experience have to do that, because a lot of decisions which have to be taken, a lot of things to creating things, you must know a lot of things, you must have overview. And my personal vision was I wanted to create something where we have a real chance to make fundamental photonic quantum research available and make it ready for technology and see how far we can go. And this is why I went to Paderborn, by the way, because I really realized if you really want to do real impact in photonics, we need a lot of different expertise on site. And I'm quite proud how much expertise we have on site. But if you have this vision, it doesn't come for free. And the thing which I enjoy most is still being together with my group, being together with my PhD students, master students, and bachelor students, so all of them there, together with my postdocs, and talk with them and doing science. And I really enjoy that the most. Days, unfortunately, there's not many days where I only do that, but this is for me still the most enjoyable thing. And yes, I still participate quite a lot. So I read all the theses of my group. I talk to my people.
You are also a part of the Science Council of Germany and certainly dealing with the structural challenges of education in physics. As a professor as well, what is your approach to education, especially in your research area?
I think it's not only for photonic quantum computing or photonic quantum technologies. I think education is one of the most important topics because we don't know what future will bring. But I think we are pretty sure that quantum technology will play a role. So I enjoy education a lot. And I should say that one of the joy of this, of my profession really is working together with young students. And to be very honest with you, I'm extremely proud of my team. And I should would also like to give credit to them, because at the end of the day, it's them who really push the frontiers and it's the next generation. And I really like working together. And I think we should really, from the academic perspective, also say that this is a very important outcome we create at the moment.
It makes our students like us very happy to be so appreciated.
It is. You should be. It's really, you are the future.
Okay. Thanks. Do you think you need a special educational approach when you speak of folks as such an interdisciplinary place where people meet? So how early do you think you bring this interdisciplinary knowledge to the people?
That's exactly what we're trying to create in Fox, is really a very interdisciplinary approach. Now, since you ask, it's a challenge because in quantum technology, we need very deep knowledge. So people have to understand quantum science, quantum optics. People have to understand engineering. People have to understand information science. And we discussed that a lot, and we go kind of a different route than a lot of other people do, because we believe that people still have to have an extremely good education in one discipline. So we don't educate the quantum engineer as say, but we want to educate the physicists, the computer scientists, and the engineer. And then we want to create, during the studying time, already additional courses, and we want to create an environment that people connect and talk to each other and learn or during the master's or maybe even bachelor's a little bit about the other subject. And I think there's also a great synergy with ML4Q. People should locate it in one location. They should have their home, be it from the subject or from where we are, but they should have an extremely easy access to other subjects in other places. I like this strategy a lot. We discussed it a lot because I think this can work. And this is the way we approach that at the moment.
This is also one of the goals of Ein Quantum, right?
It is. It's exactly. We want to give people at home, and this is, I mentioned already, they, you can be at a university, you can be at a Max Planck, you can be at Fraunhofer, wherever you are, and people have different interests. But that doesn't mean that you have to stick to that one and give them easy access that they can choose where they want to go to, because every person is different and every person has also different capabilities and interests. And in education, this is extremely important. You have to find for everybody, we should try to find the best place for them to be.
I think we learned a lot today about photonic platforms, and we appreciate the stance you take for women in physics. So thank you for joining us today and talking to us about these topics.
Thanks a lot.